Hi everyone. Today I am talking to Professor Simon Hall, who's Professor of Modern History here at the University of Leeds. And Simon is also the author of a fantastic new book called 10 Days in Harlem, Fidel Castro and the Making of the 1960s. Simon, I'm really excited to talk about your new book, but I wondered before we get into that, if you could tell us a little bit about your journey as a historian, so the kind of research that got you towards this topic, where you began and how you wound up where you are today.
Yes, so I'm a historian primarily of the United States of America, particularly the post-World War II United States. And most of my research over the years has focused on the long 1960s, with particular interests in civil rights, black power movements, the anti-Vietnam War protests, the kind of student movements of the 1960s. And so I've spent quite a lot of my career so far, you know, thinking about those topics and writing about them. And probably over the past 5 or 6 years or so, I've kind of broadened out a bit to look at the 60s more in a kind of global, in a global context, in the context of the global Cold War. And I've been particularly interested and more interested in the kind of global dimensions of that kind of moment of kind of rebellion, revolt and protest. And so that's one of the things that led me to this particular topic, I suppose.
So can you tell us a little bit about 10 Days in Harlem and kind of the ideas behind the book?
Yeah, so I mean, the book basically tells the story of the trip that Fidel Castro made to New York in September of 1960 to attend the 15th General Assembly of the United Nations, which was one of the big set piece sort of diplomatic sort of moments of the post-war period. And basically, you know, everybody who was everybody was there, right? You have a great galaxy of international statesmen. You've got President Eisenhower, who's near the end of his term of office. You have Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, who goes. You have Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, who's there. And as well as those, you also have a kind of flurry of figures from the from the so-called global south, from Africa and Asia. So Nehru's there, Nkrumah from Ghana is there, Nasser from the United Arab Republic is there. And basically Fidel wants in on this, right? He wants to go to the General Assembly because he sees it as a tremendous sort of platform to champion the achievements of his Cuban revolution about 18 months on from taking power. And he kind of wants to mix it with these characters, to be seen with them, and to make the case not just that his revolution is doing great things in Cuba, but that he belongs in that company and that his Cuban revolution is a kind of, it's bigger than just what's going on in Cuba. He also, I think, is keen to make a bit of mischief and tweak the tale of the Americans, because the General Assembly is taking place at a moment when Cuban-US relations are becoming particularly fraught, and Cuba is moving closer towards the Soviet Union. So the book tells the story of the trip. It tells it as a kind of a day-by-day account. It's a kind of extraordinary, madcap, anarchic, almost at times unbelievable trip. But it uses it to tell a bigger story about what's going on in the world, really.
It's such a fascinating topic, and I kind of want to dig into particular aspects of it as we go on. But one kind of brings us back to the title of the book itself, so 10 Days in Harlem, and where some of the other attendees might be living it up in the fancier hotels downtown in New York. Am I right in thinking that that's not quite what Castro does?
Yeah, so Fidel and his delegation, is about 80 members of the delegation, they initially check into quite a fancy hotel in Midtown. It's called the Hotel, the Shelburne Hotel. And they've had a lot of difficulty in finding hotel accommodations. Many hotels wouldn't take them. Well, they finally get to this hotel. But the owner of the hotel, a guy called Edward Spatz, has already made it very clear that he's only taking them in because he's been pressurized to do so by the American State Department. And he's very clear to journalists that he has no time for Castro's politics. And at one point, he even says that he hates the Cubans. So it's pretty clear that he's not going to be the most kind of hospitable he's not going to give them the most hospitable and generous welcome. And they're there for barely 24 hours before they have a big bust up about money. There's all these kind of wild rumors that circulate that the Cubans are plucking chickens in their hotel rooms and stubbing out cigars on the furniture. And anyway, Spatz demands an extra cash deposit, at which point Fidel storms out, goes off to the United Nations, harangues Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General, threatens to set up a camp in the UN Rose Garden or to sleep on the sofas, and then is eventually able to secure this alternative accommodation in the Hotel Teresa, which is, it's not just in Harlem, it's in the very heart of Harlem. It's a huge landmark symbolic building. It's and it's right in the sort of political heart of Harlem, the sort of unofficial capital of Black America. And Fidel arrives there late at night on the 19th of September. And within just a few minutes of checking in, Fidel receives his first guest. It's Malcolm X. And really that sets the tone for the rest of the stay. The Teresa becomes this great circus with crowds outside, you know, straining for a glimpse of Fidel, and also this succession of famous guests who come. So the next day, Khrushchev goes, visits, and others, you know, Nehru goes, NASA goes. So it becomes this great sort of centre of, if some of the world's eyes are on the General Assembly and what's going on at the UN, the rest of their eyes are on the Hotel Teresa and the kind of comings and goings there.
I love this idea of kind of people making the pilgrimage uptown to Harlem to meet Fidel. I suppose, can we dig into that a little bit? So something that was interesting that you mentioned is kind of the presence of so many important leaders from the global south. What kind of conversations is Castro having with them? Kind of what's up for discussion in the Hotel Teresa at this time?
Yeah, so I mean, I think a lot of it is about symbolism. So one of the key things Fidel wants to do is to be seen with these people and to have his photograph taken and to kind of make a big kind of thing about it all. There are some, I think, some serious issues that are being talked about. So in the discussions with NASA, for example, NASA is kind of talking to Fidel about whether Cuba might become part of the sort of non-aligned grouping of nations, these nations from the global south that that try not to pick sides in the Cold War contest between the United States and the Soviet Union. So that's one area of discussion that's going on. With the meeting with Nehru at the Teresa seems to go really, really well. They seem to get on, Fidel and Nehru get on really well. They talk a lot about the intricacies of land reform, which is, I don't dwell too much on those details in the book, but they do have some sort of substantive discussions in these meetings. But often it's really about the symbolic importance of what's going on. It's about Fidel showing that he's on a par with some of these, you know, iconic figures in the struggle against Western colonialism, and that he's a kind of a coming force, I suppose.
And you mentioned that among his other guests is Malcolm X. How is Castro fitting into or engaging with the politics of race in America in 1960?
Yeah, so this is like a really important moment in the history of the Black freedom struggle in the United States. The sit-in protests, the lunch counter sit-in protests in the South had started that spring in February, and it quickly kind of snowballed across the South. So it was really the start of the mass civil rights protests of the 1960s. The Cuban government, Fidel's government, you know, within just days of taking power in January 1959, had eliminated segregation in Cuban clubs, restaurants, golf courses, beach resorts, and had very publicly placed the Cuban Revolution on the side of racial equality, really. And, you know, Cuba is just 90 miles off the coast of the segregated South. And so Cuba had very quickly come to the attention of African Americans, who saw the contrast between Fidel's very rapid and bold attempt to kind of upend the racial order with President Eisenhower's much more slow and cautious approach. And a succession of delegations of African Americans had gone out to Cuba in the early part of 1960 to sort of see for themselves what was going on. So Cuba's an exciting story for African Americans. The key thing about going to Harlem is that Fidel draws the whole world's attention to segregation and racial discrimination in the North, in New York City, in a city which is, you know, America's most important city, but it's also a citadel of post-war American liberalism. And, you know, the kind of story that the American government is telling the world at this time is, you know, yeah, there is a race problem, but it's basically confined to the South because of the legacy of slavery. And, you know, it's kind of being worked through in a kind of democratic and constitutional manner. Fidel popping up in Harlem, you know, there's loads of social deprivation, problems around crime, a lot of problems around police brutality, something which is in the news at the moment, of course. You know, he brings the whole world's attention to these problems and kind of says, you know, there's segregation in the North, there's a racial problem in the North, and it's not just a Southern problem. So it's really embarrassing for the State Department and for the American government.
And it's kind of sitting in this kind of broader narrative about cultural change, I think, in the US and the wider world, the fact that this is happening in 1960, and we're just entering or about to enter kind of this moment of kind of great cultural ferment. Do you see, you know, the book is called 10 Days in Harlem and kind of refers to the making of the 1960s. Do you see these events as kind of telling us something bigger about the cultural and historical changes that are about to unfold across the US, maybe, but also across the world?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that the you know, the Cuban revolutionaries become kind of folk heroes to a generation of American leftists, particularly American college students, who kind of see Fidel as a kind of a romantic revolutionary, a kind of almost like a Robin Hood kind of figure, right? This band of kind of hipster revolutionaries that have you know, swept down from the mountains and overthrown this dictatorship. So he encapsulates a kind of sense of generational rebellion, which becomes really important as the 60s kind of unfold. And then there's a great sort of reception which is held for Fidel by a group called the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in the ballroom of the Hotel Teresa, in which they kind of invite along, you know, several hundred guests, they're the kind of literary figures, intellectuals, black freedom fighters, the beat poet Allen Ginsberg is there, and they're all sort of fawning over Fidel and his revolutionaries and wanting to get Fidel's autograph and stuff. And it's a kind of an early sign of that kind of heroizing or valorizing of a kind of radical kind of chic, I suppose, that these kind of third world revolutionaries or global South revolutionaries become some of the heroes for the student movement in the 1960s. So we get a glimpse of that, I think, in this trip that Fidel makes. And there's also a kind of just, you know, the trip is a bit, the contrast, I guess, between Fidel and President Eisenhower could not be stronger. Eisenhower is approaching 70. He's a very formal political leader. Fidel is not a formal political leader, right? He's constantly wearing his military fatigues. He seems to be improvising. There's a kind of anarchic, rip it up quality to the whole trip, which I think kind of symbolizes the way in which politics in the 60s is going to move. It's going to become more irreverent. It's going to become more unpredictable. It's going to become more rebellious.
That's fascinating. I suppose I wanted to turn now and talk a little bit about the research process for a book like this. So for a book that brings together kind of high politics at the UN with cultural change, and that is really telling a global story, even if one kind of grounded in New York at a particular moment, how do you go about actually tackling a topic like this as a researcher?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's a good question. I mean, the kinds of sources that I relied on heavily in the book were there's a lot of really great State Department material, including stuff that comes out of the embassy in Havana, that doesn't just give you the sort of US diplomat's version of events, but often includes a lot of you know, transcriptions of Cuban materials, you know, newspaper materials, radio broadcasts, and things like that, as well as a kind of a flavor for the kind of mood on the streets. I used a number of Cuban newspaper accounts, had them translated into English for me to be able to use. There's some great Cuban radio broadcasts which are available in English, which I could make use of. a few people who were there have written about it. There's a great collection of oral history recollections, particularly focused on the meeting with Malcolm X, which I was able to use. So it's a combination, really, of sort of official government records, diplomatic dispatches, newspaper and radio reports, and memoirs and oral histories, and trying to kind of bring all that together to shape it into a sort of coherent narrative, really, because there isn't a single archival collection which is, you know, called 10 Days in Harlem. You know, I can just go and pick all that stuff up, right? So it's a kind of an accumulation of things.
And following the trail in different archives and in different locations, I think is really interesting. I suppose one of the questions you must get asked a lot at the moment is about resonances and contemporary resonances of this material. So you've already mentioned, you know, things like police brutality, for instance, having, you know, upsetting and uncomfortable resonances today. I wondered if in the very charged political moment and very charged cultural moment that we're in, and that the US, of course, has been experiencing recently as well, whether you've seen kind of some maybe resonances of these narratives or recurrences of themes, or whether you think the book, I suppose, has something to say to the current moment.
Yeah, that, I mean, again, that's a really interesting question, and it's something that I have been asked about, and I've sort of thought about. I think it's tricky because a lot of it, I would say, is more about contrasts, because when you look at these figures who were there in New York in September 1960, you know, Nasser and Khrushchev and Nehru and Eisenhower and McMillan, you know, these were all serious people. You know, they were real figures of real stature. And even if, you know, they disagreed with each other or were on different sides of a kind of political divide, you know, no one could say that they weren't serious characters, you know, figures of real substance. And, you know, I think the sort of geopolitical situation at the moment, you see a lot of people who seem to be unserious, or sometimes spectacularly unserious. You know, it's sort of an age of the buffoon rather than the age of the kind of serious-minded statesperson. So, in a way, that I think there's a lot more contrast. I mean, you know, in 1960, America was in the midst of an extremely close and fiercely fought presidential election between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy. You know, as I talk now, we still don't quite know officially that Joe Biden has won the American election, although he has. But this is a much different. You know, there was never any question that there wasn't going to be a sort of orderly transition or anything like that. So in a way, the resonances are a bit depressing. I think the most resonant thing is the stuff around race, right? Which is 60 years on, we're still talking about racial discrimination, police brutality, a lack of economic opportunities, a kind of denial of the American dream to a significant proportion of the population. So that is, as someone who's a historian of the civil rights movement, That is a slightly depressing side of the story, I suppose, but it's one that resonates strongly.
Absolutely, at this, and particularly right at this moment, as we, I'm sure you also have a tab open waiting to see when they call Pennsylvania. Yeah. So it's been an interesting few days. I wanted to ask one last question, if I could, Simon, and this is to kind of more to do with your teaching here at Leeds. And I suppose I wanted to ask to what extent the research that you do informs the kind of teaching that you do here. Do students tend to kind of encounter the sources or the ideas that you're working with in your classes?
Yeah, they do. And there are two modules where that happens, really. There's a level two, second year optional module I teach on America and the 1960s. And one of the things we look at there is the kind of global 60s. And you know, the Cuban Revolution is a really important part of that story of the global 60s. I also teach a final year special subject on the American Civil Rights Movement, and we have a class, one of the seminar classes on that is on you know, the place of the Black freedom struggle in the United States within the broader kind of global moment or movement, I suppose. So I think it's called something like Civil Rights and the Global South, and we look particularly at the relationship between civil rights activists and the Cuban Revolution. And so that's an opportunity for me to share my research with students, but also to, you know, show them and get them to look at some of the documents that I have kind of collected in the process of writing the book, to kind of get a real flavor of, you know, this isn't just a connection which is made at a sort of an abstract level. These involve, you know, actual people, right, who go to Cuba, come back from Cuba, talk about Cuba, are interested in what's going on in Cuba, and are inspired by the Cuban Revolution in the way that they understand and organize for kind of meaningful social and political change in the United States.
That's fantastic. So that's the kind of thing that people can encounter in the teaching. That's really, really wonderful. Simon, thank you so much. We'll finish by reminding people that 10 Days in Harlem is published by Faber & Faber, is located directly above your right shoulder, I do believe.
It's a beautiful cover, yeah.
It's a really stunning cover, and is available, it's lovely to be able to say it, in all good bookshops. Thank you so much, Simon.